All right. I feel super honored to have this position to introduce this guy. I feel like there's plenty of people in this room that can do this, but this guy means a lot to me. Just a little personal story. I was about 3 weeks sober, and I had decided that I wanted to go ahead and drink, that I had spent enough time being sober, and I wanted to drink that day. And a friend of mine had told me about this meeting. She was like, it's this place called Rebos, and it's sober backwards. And she said, there's a meeting at 11 o'clock, you know, and I pulled it up on my app, and it was like 2 miles away. So I promised myself if I could just get to that meeting, I would go to the liquor store after the meeting. That was kind of the deal I made with myself. And I walked into Rebus, and she was like, you know, you might want to carry somebody with you. It's a little sketchy, and, you know. And so I'm like walking in there with my purse, and I sit in the back, and I was the only one at the table, and this guy comes in and sits next to me. I'm going to get emotional. And he shared at the very end of the meeting, and I don't know exactly what the share was, but it was basically that we have a daily reprieve in this program, and all I had to do was stay sober for that day. And there was something about that share, something about that day, something about the way that he shared it, that I was able to go home and stay sober that day. And he continues to do that 5.5 years later for me. I see this guy pop up everywhere. I've been in Atlanta the past month telling everybody about Frog is going to speak at First Friday, and people are like, yeah, Frog, yeah. So I'm super excited with his pink phone case. I always think that's hilarious, to introduce Frog, my friend.
My name is Frog, and I'm cured. And all my friends said,
bullshit.
And that's a fact, Jack. I don't know if this is coming across loud. I have hearing aids, and the acoustics in this room really suck sometimes. I'm coming across okay. Okay, thank you for all coming. Y'all have a wonderful week, and we'll see you later. I found these rooms several days ago, not because I wanted it, because I needed it. Going back to the very first time, I was going through some difficulties with my wife at the time. And I said, yeah, I have a drinking problem. And I got my wallet out and I says, I've got this number for a clubhouse in Smyrna. I can go down there. It was Rebos. That bought me a little time. I came into the clubhouse and I sat down and listened to all these stories. And that's what I did, I just listened. Then I had to apply them. So we'll go back to the start. I was born in a poor southern town in the deep southern part of Wisconsin. Population about 90 until you added my cousins and aunts and uncles, and then it got up to 120. There were three taverns, a school, a Catholic church, and a dance hall. So what did everybody do on the weekends? They partied. I was too young to know that, but I had my first sip of wine along the way, and I thought, hey, this is great. Well, not really. But my mother and father were both hard workers. My mom was raised by an alcoholic dad who beat them. And my dad was raised by a stern Austrian farmer. So my mom was very strict on everything. My dad liked to party, and he would on the weekends. I never saw him really snot-slinging drunk, but I saw him high a couple of times. And I was telling my friend Barb on the way over here, I said, I think this is the very first time that they introduced the thing of Al-Anon to the alcoholic. Only it didn't work. My mother kept preaching, my dad kept drinking, and we were miserable. Didn't know anything about this. I was raised in a farming community, and there was a city near there that went to a place called Port Washington High. When I got there, I was different. I was the country boy, the bumpkin, didn't fit in anywhere. But I found something along the way, a magic elixir. They called it beer. The earliest run-in I had with that, I guess I was about 14, a friend of mine and I broke into my girlfriend's house, stole 4 bottles of liquor from her dad's medicine cabinet, got drunk and as a stunk, got our stomachs pumped and thought, I will never do this again. Bullshit. Forgot about all of that. When I got to high school, I was a little taller, and in Wisconsin at the time, you could buy beer if you were 18. So that was my in. I could buy the beer at the beer stores, at the bars, and I could give it to my friends. That made me part of. Alcohol was never my problem, never. It was always my solution. Felt bad, had a drink. Felt good, had a drink. Didn't feel, had a drink. Started feeling hungover because I didn't have anything to drink. I had a drink. I did this through my adult life. I was a closet drinker. But then after school, I had to do something with my life. I was fed up with Holy Cross, Wisconsin, Belgium, Wisconsin, Port Washington, Wisconsin. And a friend of mine said, why don't we join the military? Hey, good idea. So we went down to enlist in the United States Army. Went through all the rigmarole, told them all about my history, told them I had asthma, and they said, you are unacceptable, 4F, get out of here. Oh shit, now what do I do? Well, 6 months later, I went to another recruitment. It was the United States Marine Corps. Hoorah! But I didn't tell them about my shortcomings, my asthma. You know, once I got out of Wisconsin with all that pollen and all of that, it never bothered me. And I left my drinking career back there in Wisconsin. For the next 12 weeks, I was cold-ass sober. They called it boot camp. I died several times, but I made it through it. Then we went to another thing called advanced military training. You know what happens in the Marine Corps? They take everything out up here, throw it away, and they program you to be an intentional automatic killer, automatic doer. Don't question, do. Well, I got to that point. But you know, as recreation, when the day was over, there was the enlisted men's club. This is further down the line after boot camp. Enlisted men's club beer was free. It was plentiful. And again, had problems, had a drink. Felt good, had a drink. Felt bad, had a drink. That all worked real well until, I don't know, about 3 years into the service, and I was having a particularly bad night this particular day. And I decided I'm going to be a John Wayne expert. I had drank about a half quart of Mount Vernon bourbon. And I come into the barracks, and I see this window and said, by God, if John can do it, I can do it. I dove through it. Didn't make it. Made it halfway through, and I still have a chip of glass in my stomach. Did I quit drinking? Hell yes, I quit drinking. 3 or 4 months. I did not have a drop. I was a dry drunk. And then I'll say, I'll just have one. And then we'll just have one more. Well, this evening we were going to a football game on base. I was off duty in civilian clothes and we're having a good time. And as we were a little bit rowdy, and the little MPs came up and says, you're making too much noise, see me after the game. So me and my buddy said, okay. So after the game, we saw them. They said, you're making too much noise, you're rowdy, you're going to have to go around and pick up all the trash around the field. Big deal, I was enjoying it, had a good time, came back and the officer of the day was there then. We were having a good time and he looked at me and he says, you're not through yet, go around and pick up all the pop tops and cigarette butts under the bleachers. You know, in my wisdom, I says, who is he going to tell that to? I'm a corporal, by God. He can't do that. And I said, with all due respect to your rank, Captain, hang it in your ass. In a split second, there were two MPs on either side escorting me to the brig. Was I drunk? Oh, hell yeah. Was I going to get sober? Hell yeah. It cost me a rank, a fine, and 15 days in confinement. When I got out, did I change? Hell yes, I didn't have another drink until I got out. When I got out of the Marine Corps, I moved to a town called Marietta, or Smyrna, at the time, Smyrna, Georgia. I had been dating and talking to a girl online, met her at Jacksonville Beach. And we had conversed and we were going to get married. When I got out, guess what? We got married. I quit drinking, cold sober. That lasted for a while. You know, white knuckling it, I was going to Sunday school, I was teaching, I was in the choir, I was all of these goody two-shoes. And then I went to work for Southern Bell, the old phone factory. You know, they had a labor union there. And being from the North, I was aware of the labor unions and what they could do, so I joined it. Then one day they asked me, would you care to be a job student? I said, sure, I can do this. See, I'm still sober, I'm dry. I haven't had a drink in several years. Then one Saturday morning they says, meet us over at the Union Hall. We're going to Macon for a meeting with the Mucky Mucks, a state meeting. And I says, okay. So I get in the car and they said, be careful, don't rattle that bag. I said, what is it? They said, it's booze. And I said, cha-ching. Oh my God. We were on our way to Macon, Georgia for a weekend. I haven't had anything to drink in a couple of years. I am going to enjoy myself. So again, I had one. And the hangover Monday was miserable. By God, I'm not going to do that again. And I didn't again for another period of time. And then there was another major convention. This time I think it might have been for a week. Same thing. Went down there, drank, had a good time, added to my story, didn't get into any trouble, just got drunk. Snot slinging drunk. I fell all over myself. Don't remember much of it. Got back to Marietta, I went to work and felt shitty. And that lasted for a while then. I finally got to a point where I was drinking too much. And again, the wife has said something about I was drinking. So I says, well, I'm going to go check out Rebo's again. So I did. I came there and I sat in the back of the room and I listened to all the stories. And there was a guy, I think his name was Bill Morrow. He was a boilermaker from Chicago and his wife was a petite little lady. And he was saying something like, if you want what we got, good. If not, get your ass out of here. Go get drunk. I don't give a shit. I thought, who is that asshole? And then his wife said, now, Bill, don't say that. You're going to hurt somebody's feelings. He said, fuck it. If they want to get drunk, let them get drunk. So I stuck around and I did the stories. I lived all of that. And then I got sober and I stayed sober for a pretty good length of time. White knuckling it. Quit drinking, got involved with the Boy Scouts. I was a scout leader. My sons were Eagle Scouts. They worked up through that. I was involved with the adult leaders training of Boy Scouts. I was sober, man. I had it made. Wow. Good as you look at me. Sometimes I wore a suit, sometimes slacks and a nice shirt. I'm somebody. And then we started going through the divestiture of the system, breaking it up in 1983. And then I got the word from one of my bosses who said, Ken, we got a job at Warner Robins, Georgia. It's going to last for a while. Would you be interested in going there? But, oh, wow, good deal. I can get away from the pressures of home. And I got down there, and it was great. Many a times in my life, I thought, I wish I was in a place where I could cuss when I wanted to, pick my nose when I wanted to, fart when I wanted to, because there was nobody there to impress. That was Warner Robins. They put me in room 262. And for the next 11 months, that's where I was. There was a guy named Joe Cunningham went down there with me. He had like 12 or 14 years. And he said, hang around with me, you'll be okay. So I did. First night we went down to the hospitality yard, and they had wings and all these hors d'oeuvres. They had orange juice and grapefruit juice and white wine. And, oh no, I'm not gonna have any of that. I just had orange juice and the hors d'oeuvres. Second night I did the same thing. Joe was with me. Third night, oh shit, where's Joe? He didn't come down, so I said, okay, guess what? I can have one glass of wine. So I did. The next night I went down there, they did this 5 days a week. The next night I went down there and I did the same thing and I had two glasses of wine. And it was okay. And that went on for the 11 months that I was down there, but it progressively got worse. Many years ago as a kid, I hunted a skunk in Wisconsin. And my cousin and I, we hunted this thing down. And we thought with our wisdom, if we put an arrow behind its head, he cannot spray us and we won't smell it. So we did that. To our chagrin, it was such a buildup, we didn't notice, but everybody else did. When we came into my little community, everybody knew we were coming. He got a whipping from his folks, I got a whipping from mine, and that's the way Warner Robins was. It was building up to a degree where I didn't notice it, but everybody around me did. Got back up here, settled down into the routine, but this time I didn't have the Boy Scouts, I didn't have the church, I didn't have anything to keep me sober. So I was miserable, and that went on for maybe a year and a half. Finally, it got to a point. I was working at an office building. I was then promoted to another level in the company. I was working in office buildings, pulling in wires for a switchboard, and I was sweating bullets. I thought, this isn't any good. So I went out and I got a pint of Seagram's 7 Gin. That was top shelf. That was good stuff. Well, before I got back to the job, I was the only one there. Before I got back there, I had about a third of that. Oh, I started feeling good for the next 5, 10, 15 minutes. Then after that, I didn't feel so good. So I went out to the truck. At about 10 o'clock, I had some more, and then there was only maybe a third left. About 10, 11:30, I went back for the last bit, and I knew that was not going to last. And I knew in my heart that the seed had been planted. What are you going to do about yourself now, youngster? I thought, I know where Rebos is. And by this time, they had left the little house. They built the building, and they had the building that they are now. So I went in there that particular August 22nd of 89. And I sat down at the back table, and when they had asked for people if they had a problem, I raised my hand and said, my name is Ken and I'm an alcoholic, I need help. Don't remember much more than that. But after the meeting, some people talked to me. Here I am still in a suit kind of thing, shirt and tie, neat and all that. And I keep coming back. They say, keep coming back. So I did. And eventually, I got to where I was comfortable with myself. And then it was a rainy July, August, a rainy night. I heard these motorcycles come up. And I was riding a Honda at the time. And by this time, I had gotten into jeans and boots and a shirt. And I want what they had. And they came in, they were soaking wet. A guy named Travis told his story. And I said, by God, I want what they have. You know, I still tell people, I think I said, told this to Jen, I know I have to several people in here, I want what you have today. It has nothing to do with not drinking, it's because of the spirit, the wisdom, the inner drive that you have. And I talked to this guy, Travis, after, and he says, well, if you want what we've got, you've got to do what we've done. So that's what I started doing. I started to prospect with the Fifth Chapter Motorcycle Club. That's what this t-shirt is all about. The prospect, that means you're a step and fetch it, almost a slave to the club. You'll do whatever they want you to do, whenever they want you to do it. And you do it willingly because everybody who's been in the club, is in the club, did the same thing. But along the way, I learned a different set, a good set of tactics, a good set of morals, a good set of principles. Not what you see on the TV shows, not what you see on these documentaries. But I learned that, and eventually I was awarded the Fifth Chapter Colors. And that was a highlight in my life. Rocked on great, everything, peaches and cream. We did rides to Florida nonstop, to Key West. We rode to Wisconsin nonstop. Did all these good things until one fretful day, December 2nd of 93, I think. We were summoned to a meeting in Orlando, Florida. And another club was there, and they looked at us and said, take off all your Fifth Chapter shit. It does not exist anymore. And if we see you flying with it, we're liable to kill you. If you've got a tattoo of it, we'll rip it off. And one by one, there were 14 of us around the table that got beaten. And we were sent about our way. I stopped at a gas station nearby and told a couple of my buddies, three of my buddies that rode down from Wisconsin, from Georgia with me, came out. And we took off for a motel. Not scared shitless, but we were petrified. We didn't know what else was happening. We made it back to Georgia, and the very first person I saw was Travis. Now he's 6'4 and 250. I walked him at the hole in the wall and gave him a hug and started crying. And he said, it's going to be okay. For the next 5 or 6 months, my bike sat out in the weather. I didn't pay any attention to it, nothing. And I was miserable. I was still working the program. I was doing okay, but that was a serious, serious effect on me. And I had every right in the world to say, fuck it, I'm gonna go get drunk. I deserve it. They treated me poorly, but I didn't. One of the reasons I didn't was I looked around and said, if I take that drink, I cannot ride with them again. That was strong enough to get me over the hump. It was maybe 6 weeks after that we were contacted by the FBI. Myself, Bones, and a couple of other guys asked if we would be willing to testify against them. And I said, yes, that makes me a snitch. You know what a snitch is? It's not good. You're dead meat. That in itself would be enough to drive me to drink, but I didn't. Because again, I would be letting down what I had come to learn about, this honor. We did that, the trial went on, it was public. These guys were sentenced from 8 to many years. There was 15 of them. Went on with my life. And then I came across another group of riders. Why do I pick on motorcycles? Well, that had always been a niche for me. I always wanted to be something outside, glamorous. And a motorcycle did that. It gave me a freedom you can't explain. I used to have a t-shirt, if I have to explain, you wouldn't understand. Well, I joined another club. That ended badly because when my dad died, I was going through a lot of things. They said, you gotta do this and that. And I took about a month off and I covered about 5,000 miles on my bike trying to get my head straightened out. And the rewards for that was when I got back home and says, take off your shit, you don't exist anymore. By God, that's another disappointment. I should go out and get drunk over this. But I didn't, because of what I've learned in the book. Along the way, there was a fellow that rode with us. His name was Caveman. On May 24th, about 20 years ago, the cops blew him away. He was a member. They blew him away. They call it suicide by cop. We went to his funeral. You know, that was another reason to drink. But if I do, I'm going to spoil the memory of him and hundreds of others. Now, I've got all these little things. I had a visitor last night come to my house. He had 10 years sober. Now I'm jumping ahead, but that's okay, fire me. He had 10 years sober, but he says, Rog, it was the process. They were crushing me. I had to do this and I had to do that and blah, blah, blah. And he finally, it got to a point when my friend died and I went to the funeral and I couldn't take it anymore. I went out and got drunk. And I said, by God, Chuck, that's a damn good reason. Now what you got? I don't have shit. What he didn't do in that time was he didn't go to meetings, he didn't read a big book, no spiritual connection with God or anybody else. So of course he was relying on himself. I've had all these brothers and sisters to rely on. And it pays off. One step at a time. You know, something I wanted to mention early on is, you know, I said I'm cured and all that. I meant to say also that something I'll do here is I'll tell you stories, but I won't lie to you. Jamma's looking over there like, what the hell does that mean? And I said, well, a lie is something I'll tell you to entertain or teach. A lie is something that I'll do tell you to deceive you. I will not lie to you, but I'll tell you stories about where I was. That's how I kept sober through all of this. There was a place that was called the Hole Recovery Center. Some people may remember that. It was a bunch of misfits. It was a spin-off of Rebo's, who was a spin-off of Jim City, who was a spin-off of somebody else. But anyhow, that's the way AA got it going. Anyhow, it was a clubhouse where everybody was welcome. Nasty couches. We had meetings around the room. And it was smoking loud. And you couldn't tell the people from the smoke. And that lasted for almost 19 years until somebody decided to do a hatchet job on the leadership. And they said, basically, you as the corporation don't exist. This is what we're going to do. And they did, and it did, and it went by the wayside. But out of that, I still have memories of Jocko and Travis and Kate and many others that were there that helped me through it all. My sobriety has meant everything to me. And how did I keep it? It's real simple. We can go through the steps. Oh, there's one other thing I was going to mention. I told my girlfriend the other day, I've got OCD. She looked at me and says, what's that? She knows. Obsessive compulsive behavior. Because I'll get on a train of thought, and that's all that counts. I was going to buy a new motorcycle. I was hell bent on getting a new motorcycle. I had the money set aside. I knew where it was. I knew who I was talking to. By God, I was going to do it. I didn't talk to God about it. I was coming home from CVS Pharmacy in my van, and it quit on Concord Road. A friend of mine dragged me out of the street. We carried to the shop, and my mechanic friend that I've known for years said, "You got a seized engine. We can fix it." I says, "How much?" He says, "About $10,000." I says, "Shit, the car isn't worth that." He says, "Well, that or you could scrap it." And then the light bulb went off. God had blown up my car to tell me not to do the motorcycle, that the money that I had put aside for the motorcycle now went for that Kia little hatchback that I'm driving. Imagine me in a little hatchback Suburban. No, I'm a biker, I'm a tough ass. I tell folks when I got here, I wore a suit and all that, and I tell folks, I looked neat on the outside, but I was dog shit on the inside. Now I've turned that around. I look like dog shit, but I'm neat on the inside, and I carry that everywhere as I go. So after that, I got rid of the van. My kids helped me find this key, and here I go, this puttering old guy with tattoos and this Kia. Well, this isn't all that. I still want a motorcycle. So I'm thinking, how am I going to get a motorcycle? And I'm thinking, I've got a perfectly good one out there I could ride. And Libby, my wife, when she passed away, I got her little Suzuki's 250 that had been unwilling to get rid of. And finally it dawned on me, I could trade those in on a lesser motorcycle. And the light bulb came on and said, God said, that sounds like a deal. So I did. So I got rid of my big motorcycle. Libby would have been proud for me to get rid of her motorcycle. And I came out of that even trade. Was that an accident? No, it's part of what God does for me when I'm too stubborn for myself. Somewhere along the way, I like to tell you about the steps. Has anybody in here taken the steps? Bullshit. If you've taken them, you haven't done them. A friend of mine, I use the word bullshit. If that offends you, tough luck. A friend of mine says, you don't work the steps, you live the steps. The first time I heard that, I thought, that doesn't sound right. And then as I get into the program, I think, maybe he is right. You know, we start off with, admit it, we were powerless over alcohol, our lives had become unmanageable. Was your life manageable when you got here? Mine was, as long as I had a drink. As long as I didn't go too far without that drink. It was manageable, but I was miserable. Then they say something about, you got to make a decision and turn your will and life over to the care of God. God, to me, was that figure in the sky that my parents always threw at me. If you do that, God's going to strike you dead. He was the punishing God. But I've come to understand that God is like my parents were in many ways. They wanted the best for me, but sometimes it wasn't all that was caught up to me. My parents always loved me, but sometimes they got pissed at me. My kids the same way. I've always loved them. Sometimes I got mad at them. God has always loved me. Sometimes he said, hey, stupid, don't buy the motorcycle. So that's what I did. And then what's the next one? Make a decision. How many of us made any kind of decisions when we were out there drinking? Do I go to Windy Hill Bottle Shop or do I go to the bottle shop up on Fairgrounds? No, I went there last week. I'm going to have to go to, my decision was where I was going to get the booze. But finally, I made a decision, and it was in a trailer at a candlelight group, attended by some bikers, some good people, some bike, all steps. And at this particular meeting, they were talking about a power greater than themselves. And this led to my first psychic awakening. I was riding my Honda to Atlanta. after this meeting, and I'm screaming in my mind, I need help, I need relief. God, where are you? Can't you help me? And this is going on. And I get near my exit at 14th Street, and I get through the traffic, and I make that turn, and about the time I made the turn and straighten out, a switch was thrown from that rage to calm. And I said, okay, God, what do you want me to do? And there's a number of things that I have done since then because of that switch being thrown. I can't tell you all of them. I can tell you in a private conference. There's too many. How do you take 30 plus years of sobriety and wrap it up in 40 minutes? You don't. But then we go into the fourth step, take your inventory. You know, I've taken everybody's inventory in here. You may not realize it. You know, there's some real jerks in here. But that doesn't matter. The only inventory that matters is mine. And when I've taken it and looked at it honestly, then I act on it. How do I act on it? God already knows. I already know. But if I keep these secrets to myself, it's like a splinter I had in my good finger here, a white oak splinter. It kept festering. But it wasn't until a month later when I dug it out and it stopped hurting. And it hasn't hurt since. Once I had that fifth stop and told somebody else about it, a lot of the pain, not all of it, a lot of the pain went away. But it takes time to do this. And then, of course, we got to take care of our character defects. I've got a few. I've got some clauses in there. And then there's another one about making a list of people we have harmed. I haven't harmed anybody in my life because of my drinking. Or maybe everybody. Because I didn't give my full attention to my employer, my family, the people around me. But could I do it to all of them? Could I make amends to them all? But it says, no, you got to become willing to. And how do you do that? Some of them are dead, passed on. And it says, be willing to accept when to do so would injure them or others. You know, there's a real simple solution to that. If you seek and you ask for God's guidance. If I have done everything I can to make amends to this boy in Random Lake, Wisconsin, that I literally beat the hell out of in my junior year of high school, I'll never find him. But what I can do is write a letter in depth, address it, boy, Random Lake, Wisconsin, put a stamp on it, put it in the mail, and let God deliver it. But I've got to exhaust everything in my power before I do that. I can't leave that as a scapegoat. And then just continue to take personal inventory. Do I do that daily? Pretty much. Do I do it nightly? Do I? Yeah. Sometimes I do it on the spot. There was a guy up at the extension one time says, Frog, you can't do that. And I says, why? He says, well, you're not a member here. And I says, well, JJ said I could. He said, well, we'll see about that. He didn't know how important I was. Well, there were two people sitting at the table. So I went and talked to JJ, and so did, I think his name was Richard. Came back, and the guy was wrong. I had the right to be there. That made me okay. But the very first thing I thought about, I need to apologize to this guy because I was a horse's ass in front of these two guys. And I found those guys that night and sat down with him and I apologized for my part in it. It doesn't excuse it, I just had to make things right. And it was okay. I've applied that to my life several times. It comes automatically. Sought through prayer and meditation, how often do we do that? I ask God frequently for things, but then I don't give him time to answer. By God, I want that bike now. Nope, not going to happen. Slow down. More will be revealed. And I can't tell you the number of times things like that have happened in my life where when I turned loose of it and let God, he did. and then became willing to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And then the big kicker, and practice these principles in all our affairs. That wraps up everything in the steps, the big book, the 12 and 12, the living sober. And if you do that daily, you're going to be okay. And I mentioned earlier that this obsessive, compulsive behavior, I made a commitment this year that I haven't done since my wife passed away, that I was going to make some God boxes for the women's extension and the men's extension. And that was my priority for the next 4 weeks. And when I got tired, I stopped. When I felt like it, I did again. And this finger, I've had 8 stitches, and this one, I've had 12, because when I was doing that in the past, I didn't stop. The first thing I thought was, okay, God, I got the message. This time, when I was tired, I stopped. And I was able to make that commitment and give them to those folks up there. And what is a God box? I used mine last night when I had my drunk friend over. I put a note on it. Said, God, I cannot handle this. Tell me what to do. These are the God boxes for anybody who wants them when you, after the show, or whatever this is. And I put that in the God box, and I tapped it like that, and when it down, I instantly felt better. That didn't mean the problem was over, but I had given it to God, and he was going to tell me what to do. He did, and I have since then. But it's not until I am willing to do it, submit it to God, and move on. These God boxes are unlike some of the commercial ones. Once you put it in there, you can't take it out. What good is a God box if you're going to give it to God and then take it out? He might say, look stupid, I got to keep your fingers out of it. He's not going to talk to you like that. But that's a summary of everything that I've gone through in my sobriety, that I have not found it necessary to drink. My wife was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. She lived 6 miserable months after that. And I was there for her with her sister, with her daughter and her sisters and others. And I'll tell you, I use God, not necessarily the God box, but I use God. I don't think I've ever been that close to another human being. Because she was laying there, she was smiling every once in a while, and I said, we're going to take you out for a ride. She smiled. You know, those little things, those are things that can never go away, and a drink will never replace. I've debated on what I was going to do for a closing, and I haven't made up my mind yet. So I think we'll go with this one. I've got several that I've used. This is an old Cherokee Indian, a tale from a Cherokee Indian chief. And it says, it's a tale of two wolves. One evening, an old Cherokee told his grandson about the battle that goes on within them. He said, my son, the battle is between two wolves in you. It goes on and on. One is evil. It is always angry, envy, jealous, sorrow, regret, grief, arrogance, self-pity, resentment, false pride, superiority, and ego. He said the other one is good. It is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, forgiveness, truth, benevolence, compassion, and faith. The Cherokee Indian asked his grandson, his grandfather, said, grandfather, which one wins? And he said, the one you feed. We're constantly fighting a battle against alcoholism. I and we are never going to be cured of it. but I do have a daily reprieve based on my spiritual conditioning, and I do that daily. Thanks for letting me ramble.
So good. Thank you so much, Frog, for coming out.